Hello, I'm Lynn Ahmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the show today, we will discuss climate change with an exclusive interview with Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Later on, we will look at medical brain drain and its impact on African health systems. But first, world leaders are gathered in Glasgow, Scotland this week for a pivotal climate summit, COP26. According to the United Nations, around 4 billion people have been affected by climate change-related events over the past decade, including deadly floods, wildfires, drought, and malnutrition. Experts warn that global warming could reach catastrophic levels if more is not done to address issues such as reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But global pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions are just a fraction of what's needed to prevent catastrophic global warming. That's the warning from the United Nations as world leaders try to agree on further action during COP26 climate summit. Henry Ridgewell looks at what is at stake.
At the 2015 Paris Climate Summit, world leaders pledged to restrict global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But those promises are not being matched with policies, according to the United Nations Emissions Gap Report, published Tuesday. It warns that new commitments to reduce emissions made in the run-up to the Glasgow summit, known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, will reduce greenhouse gases by just 7.5% by 2030 compared to previous pledges. Restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require emissions cuts of 55%.
So far, we have heard lots of political support for enhanced ambition of mitigation, but the concrete pledges have still been missing. And at the moment, we are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees warming rather than 1.5 to 2 degrees.
So what does that mean for the planet and for humankind? Scientists say climate change is already increasing the frequency and intensity of heat waves. A recent report from Chatham House calculated that globally, heat-related mortality has increased by nearly 54% among the elderly since the turn of the century, reaching 296,000 deaths in 2018.
We expect around about 400 million people to be experiencing heat waves to the extent that they're no longer able to work outside.
Heat waves and droughts would have a big impact on global food security. Crop failures and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases, such as the locust plague in East Africa last year, would lead to soaring prices.
Over the next 30 years, about 50% more food is going to be required due to more people being on the planet, but also expectations around eating more meat, particularly in countries like China and Southeast Asia and so on and so on. But at the same time, under our assessment, we anticipate yields, harvests, to decline by around about 30%.
Warmer temperatures lead to more intense tropical storms and flooding. Longer term, melting ice caps will lead to sea level rises, putting coastal cities at risk. Extreme weather fluctuations also mean more intense and more prolonged droughts. Scientists say richer nations must deliver on their 2015 promise to help poorer nations pay for combating climate change and deal with its impacts.
The big cascading impacts that we see coming out of drought, heat waves, agricultural drought, are migration, food insecurity for everyone, and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases. So there's a vested interest for those wealthy countries to ensure that the climate finance, that $100 billion per year that's been pledged for some time since Paris and before, is actually delivered upon. And it's not being delivered upon at the moment.
As world leaders prepare for Glasgow, the stakes for our planet and for the human race are getting higher, the impacts close to irreversible. Can a new global agreement be reached to slash emissions well beyond current commitments? Summit host, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, gave his assessment Monday.
I'm very worried because it might go wrong, and we might not get the agreements that we need, and it's touch and go. It's very, very difficult.
Scientists say the outcome of the Glasgow summit will likely affect each and every one of us on a warming planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
For more on climate change and what's at stake, I spoke with Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, in an exclusive interview. He joined me from the COP26 summit in Glasgow.
Bill Gates, thank you so much for joining us today. You are attending the 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26, in Glasgow. Help us visualize the scope of the problem when it comes to climate change. What are we facing and how much should we be concerned?
Well, climate change is one of the biggest challenges mankind has ever faced, because year by year, because of these carbon emissions, the climate will be getting hotter. And that means particularly anywhere near the equator, the ability to do outdoor farming or outdoor construction work will become impossible. And so that'll really destabilize people who live in these tropical zones. And so we have to do two things. We have to stop those emissions where there's the ambitious goal to do that by 2050. And then in the meantime, we need to help countries adapt to these changing weather conditions. For example, you know, giving them better seeds that can deal with the increased temperature. And so, you know, this meeting, I was at the Paris meeting 6 years ago. This one's, you know, bigger and broader. So there is some attention, but, you know, we still have to do a lot more.
So you mentioned the Paris meeting, which happened in 2015. So some commitments were made about fighting climate change. It was a global synergy that was created, limiting global temperature rises to 1.5 degree and also cutting greenhouse gas emission. How much progress have been made since then? And how are we going to know that COP26 is a success?
Well, I think that there's two ways to look at COP26. One is to say, what have we accomplished in the last 6 years? And there, I think we can feel optimistic that we've deeply engaged the private sector. We've identified the need for innovation and how we get every sector working together to drive that innovation. And we're now paying a significant effort to adaptation. And so those three things were not there in Paris. I'm not saying that the commitments here are good enough. We need to say over the next 5 years, the same type of increased engagement on the different issues, you know, better policies, more private sector, more innovation, including the innovation that's focused on the adaptation. For example, announcements that the foundation and others will make about improving seeds for all countries.
Now, innovation is something that you discuss in your book you released this year, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. What sorts of innovation you just mentioned, seed, what else are you referring to when in terms of innovation?
Well, the big announcement from us and is that we're part of the AIM for C, Adaptation Innovation for Climate Change. And a big part of that is this helping the smallholder farmers. And so a number of countries are announcing increased resources, including President Biden will make significant announcements. We're announcing $315 million over the next 3 years for the seed consortium, which is called the CG system, that makes the seeds for all the different countries. And the big priority for that money will be seeds that can be even more productive despite the challenge of climate change. And so overall, we expect that an additional $1 billion, including our money, will be committed to that effort. So that has the potential to benefit literally hundreds of millions of these smallholder farmers. So probably won't get the attention it deserves, but probably the biggest move for adaptation using innovation for that that will be announced here.
Now, climate change does not affect everyone the same to the same degree. Some studies show that poor families in developing countries are often the least to blame for man-made climate change. However, they bear the worst of the impact with diseases like malaria and diarrhea and malnutrition. What are your thoughts on the impact of climate change in underdeveloped countries, especially in a region like Africa?
As you say, it's a great injustice. And in fact, my interest in climate change came from seeing that through our agricultural work in Africa, the farmers were often having a more difficult time. And so they're already facing these difficulties, which will get significantly worse between now and the end of the century. And so I studied the issue of climate change, and the Gates Foundation took on this adaptation as a big priority. That wasn't getting much attention, so I joined together with some others to create the Commission on Adaptation, and we had people like the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, we had Kristalina Georgieva, we had Ban Ki-moon, a lot of great participation, and did a report that highlighted some of these key investments. And so, you know, it is, you know, I hope at this COP, along with the private sector engagement and innovation, that the adaptation agenda is the thing that people are surprised that, you know, now we're talking about it. And in some areas we have a plan, in some areas we still don't have a plan.
What about at the community level and at the individual level, Mr. Gates? What do you think all of us can do to contribute in this global solution in fighting climate change?
Well, certainly there are products that have lower emissions. It'll be very different in different countries. You know, in the rich countries, you know, we are starting to have food indications of which kinds of food cause what emissions. You know, we have more and more electric cars. You know, we have the ability to heat your home with what's called an electric heat pump versus using hydrocarbon like natural gas to heat your house. You know, I would say that for the individual, a political engagement is also important, because this is a problem where we have to make near-term investments, you know, even some short-term sacrifice, to get the long-term benefit of not having drastic climate change impacts. And so educating people that this is very worth doing, particularly getting young people engaged, you know, they're the ones who that will have to deal with these problems, but it's, you know, we have to start now on this work. So it's, you know, it's a tougher problem to solve than even say the pandemic was. The pandemic, we invented one tool. You know, we still don't have that out to everyone, but the vaccine gave us a chance to finish over time the pandemic. With climate change, we need lots and lots of tools. And so as you move, you know, into developing countries, you know, they're, you know, understanding how the agricultural ecosystem can work, and having policies about land development, you know, it is a sad fact that there's a lot of deforestation. And so the tropical forests are very important to preserve, you know, so the whole world wants to help preserve the tropical forests in Brazil, Africa, and in Southeast Asia, you know, and so far we're not doing a great job on that. So we have, you know, we have to figure that out. You know, Africa so far is there's less destruction there, but as we do the normal thing of building roads, that could make the situation even worse.
And finally, Mr. Gates, there are those who still don't believe in climate change, whether it's by willful ignorance or factual ignorance. What do you say to them?
Well, fortunately, that's a smaller and smaller group. You know, and we, you know, the evidence, sadly, is getting much stronger. You know, as you see these different weather events, and you see these natural ecosystems, things like coral reefs, dying off, you know, there's no other explanation. We also have to worry about people who think this is an easy problem to solve. We have to convince them that it's a hard problem, but we don't want to have people despair. We need a sense of energy and optimism. You know, I believe this is a very solvable problem. You know, I've seen innovation work in many sectors, like new vaccines, you know, where we've reduced childhood death very dramatically. Of course, we need to do more there. But, you know, my experience in these last 6 years is that we really are starting the innovations. I've been able to fund through my breakthrough energy efforts a lot of new companies. And now the next 5 years, we need to take those ideas and deploy them, not just in the rich world, but also in developing countries, including Africa.
Bill Gates, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now, some farmers and organizations in Africa are adopting smart and technology-based solutions as the continent seeks to prepare itself for the effects of climate change. In Kenya, one group has invested in cold storage facilities to ensure that excess agricultural produce that would have otherwise become gas-producing waste is collected, stored, and distributed to those in need, including victims of drought. Brenda Mulinya reports from Nairobi.
For close to 5 years, Food Bank in Kenya has been helping people like Lillian Vihenda feed their families. In the current hard economic times in Kenya, Lillian says these care packages from the non-profit group help keep her children in school.
The money that I would have used to buy food that I now get from the food bank, I use it to pay for my children's school fees, which is a great help.
The organization salvages abandoned excess food from farms and markets and stores it for distribution to the needy and vulnerable. The food bank's mission to eradicate hunger and tackle food waste has also morphed into a campaign to stop the harmful impact of climate change. John Gadungu, the nonprofit's head, says the recent acquisition of a cold storage facility is enabling the food bank to store more and reduce greenhouse emissions from the farms.
When food in the farms ends up in the landfills, you find that there is a lot of toxicity within the air, because what happens is that when they rot in the landfill, they produce methane, which is a worse product than carbon dioxide. And if we curb food wastage, we can be able at least to reduce the amount of of gas that is produced from at least 6 to 8%.
Smart agriculture and technological advances will be key to helping Africa adapt and mitigate climate change impacts, says analyst Winnie Haimba.
Agricultural technologies that also ensure that you have reduced emissions, CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions, and so on, which are all greenhouse gases, are really, really important. So we really, I need of these technologies, and then also the capacity to be able to apply these technologies.
But technology requires funding, and that remains a challenge. Experts say the continent will need more than $300 billion over the next decade as it develops strategies that will help cushion it from the effects of climate change. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to medical brain drain. The WHO recommends one doctor per 1,000 people. However, Africa has about one doctor for every 5,000 people. Brain drain is one of the reasons behind the health workers' shortage, according to experts. Higher salaries and better working conditions are some incentives that lead some of Africa's medical workers to migrate to more developed countries. In Nigeria, thousands of doctors leave every year to Europe, North America, and the Middle East due to poor salaries, benefits, and working conditions back home. Nigerian health authorities are promising to improve compensation to stop the country's medical brain drain. But as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, it may not be enough.
We didn't have the materials we needed to work with, so you would see people die from preventable diseases.
Nigerian Dr. Chimezie Ibe recalls the poor state of Nigeria's health system. When he got an offer to work in Britain 2 months ago, he took it.
I left because I got frustrated. I worked in an environment where for the first 4 months of my employment, I was owed. And in these 4 months, I had bills to pay, I had responsibilities to meet up to, I had to be at work every day.
Dr. Ibe is among the some 2,000 doctors Nigeria loses every year to better paying jobs abroad, according to the country's National Medical Association. Countries such as Britain, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Canada are prime destinations. The association says poor funding, frequent strikes, overpay, and unfavorable government policies for the health sector are to blame for the medical brain drain. Money is not the only factor driving health professionals abroad, as Nigerian optometrist Ifeanyi Ugeni explains.
I want to practice in an environment where I have basically all diagnostic tools at my disposal.
Payment disputes between the government and medical practitioners have continued for years and led to strikes, the latest being the National Association of Resident Doctors strike, which was suspended early this month, more than 2 months after it began. Nigeria's Medical Association blames the migration for Nigeria's falling doctor-to-patient ratio. But some doctors like Blessing Okubo refuse to leave.
Which I have had several opportunities to work abroad, but I still chose to strengthen my country and strengthen the health sector.
This month, Nigerian authorities promised to increase pay in a bid to retain physicians. But medical expert Ejike Oji says a broader approach is needed to ensure Nigerian doctors stay.
But our healthcare system is so broken that we need a lot of resources. And we need a lot of transparency and accountability to make use of even the little that we want to put in it.
Until then, thousands of Nigerian health professionals will continue trying to get a job abroad. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
I spoke with Adebusuyi Adeyemi, Fellowship Director at Chatham House Universal Health Center in England. He elaborates on the issue of medical brain drain in Africa and what can be done.
Adebusuyi Adeyemi, thank you so much for joining us on Voice of America.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to us about medical brain drain and the scope of the problem on the African continent.
Medical brain drain has a significant impact on healthcare systems across Africa because the clinicians and healthcare professionals, healthcare workers that you would expect to be available to treat people with infectious diseases, to treat people with non-communicable diseases, is absent. And so public health threats can increase, communities don't get the healthcare that they need because their doctors and nurses aren't around to treat them. Medical brain drain is a big challenge because it's the lack of investment, it's the lack of funding that the healthcare workers need that means that they have to look for other means to make a living. There is also a little bit of a moral hazard on other countries in the West that invite those healthcare workers on, but they also have patients, they have citizens who need healthcare. And if they have the funds and we live in a free market economy, then they can put job offers out and it is then on the individuals to whether they accept or whether they apply for that. It's very incredibly difficult to put any rules and to limit restrictions on people's movement. as any individual would want to make a living. So it's really more money, more investment that's needed to attract and retain healthcare workers in African member states. And so more needs to be done perhaps on treasuries and the budgets that's devoted to healthcare across African member states.
What are some of the main causes of medical brain drain in Africa? What can you tell us?
One of the main causes is funding, really. You can imagine yourself as a doctor or as a nurse, as a clinician in an African healthcare system. And if you aren't being paid, or if you think you can get a better offer somewhere else, basic human nature would dictate that you would move to make sure you had a living. And the lack of investment in some of these African healthcare systems then means that the doctors and nurses don't get the wages that they deserve, that they think they deserve. And so they will move to other job opportunities where they can get an income and where they can also use their skills. Because if you are a doctor or a nurse and you aren't practicing over time, you will lose that skill which you originally trained for.
There are two types of brain drain, as far as I see. There are health workers who are already trained and leave the country for greener pastures, if you will. And then there are those who are traveling abroad to study but do not return. To what extent are the reasons, the causes the same, and what can be done for each group?
Yeah, the causes for medical brain drain, whether they're for people that have trained in a country and stay there, or whether they're for people that have been trained locally in their African country and then are, you know, recruited to other healthcare systems. They're slightly the same. There's lots of overlap. However, there's lots of nuance and lots of different things between one region, one country, and even within a country, within districts, why people move. Some might be due with age. Some might be due with clinical competency. Again, if you're a clinician or a surgeon who's trained in a particular space and you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the tools to actually use your skills, then you will go to other places where they have the medical equipment. So the bottom line, unfortunately, is money. As with any employment markets, as with any migration pathway, economic migration, people move to areas of work where they can use their skills, where they can earn a living. It always pretty much boils down to money. The hearts and minds of many nurses and doctors across Africa is that they want to stay. People don't want to leave their families. They don't necessarily always want to move away from where they're from. But if they can earn a better living elsewhere, then they will have to. It's probably the most sensible thing that they can do.
There are some humanitarians that say that the exodus of medical doctors, healthcare workers from Africa to other countries, more developed countries, is to some extent immoral. Do they bear some responsibilities in terms of staying on the continent to be part of strengthening the health system? Or are they right to travel abroad if things are not better in the country?
When it comes to the question of what is right or wrong for a doctor or nurse to do, for an African doctor or nurse to do, it's very hard and it's very challenging to suggest that it's immoral for them to move to get a better living for themselves. I think you would be very hard pressed to ask a nurse who isn't earning a decent living, who isn't earning the wage he or she thinks she deserves in an African country, to stay there for a patriotic, nationalistic sense of pride when they don't have the money to put foods in the mouths of their children or their families. And faced with the alternative of having a stable income from another country that can guarantee that, it's a basic human need for warmth, for food, for clothing. And so if feelings of morality, if feelings of serving your country could pay the bills, could get you food, then I'm sure people would obviously stay in the country. But the reality is it doesn't. It's hard cash and dollars and cents that pay the bills, that pay for food. And so people are pressed, unfortunately, put into situations where they have to find a way to make an economic living. So sense of immorality and what's right, unfortunately, very well-meaning sentiments that don't change the situation for individual doctors and nurses who are faced with the reality of strikes, of not getting paid on time, et cetera, et cetera.
Adebusuye Adeyemi, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Adebusuye Adeyemi, Director of Fellowship at Chatham House Universal Health Center. And that's our show for today. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations for carrying Health Chat throughout the continent. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, stay safe, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.